Hi, everybody. I'm Lyle. Steve, thanks for coming. One of the reasons we wrote this book was our feeling that despite their historical significance, these two men had not received the recognition they deserve. With this presentation, we hope to tell you a little more about them, particularly that while on the surface they differed in so many ways, in the matter of building winning baseball teams, they were very much alike. Jacob Rupert was a man of great wealth and a meticulous dresser. Damon Runyon described him as being very particular about the clothes he wore, and he always appeared well-dressed and wearing the latest fashions. Rupert used his vast wealth to indulge himself. He had a mansion on Fifth Avenue, a country estate in upstate New York, and a 113-foot yacht. He raced and bred horses, he bred dogs, and he collected rare books, art, jade pieces, and exotic animals. Miller Huggins had no interest in what others thought of him, and he certainly had no interest in his appearance. He had no extravagances in his life. His greatest joy came from fishing, puffing on his pipe, and golf, which he took up later in his life. Rupert was a risk taker, and sometimes the risks he took did not end well. He loved fast cars, and 10 years after his arrest for speeding, he was racing his motorcycle against a garage owner who was driving a car. When the car slammed into a tree, the garage owner was killed. The only time Huggins may have been seen in a car that was going too fast, it would be as a passenger. He would sometimes ride along with Babe Ruth, another fast driver and risk taker, but that was only to attempt to convince the Babe to slow down. Rupert, especially as a younger man, was a party goer and a member of many social clubs. As a congressman in Washington, he was a regular at White House receptions held by his fellow New Yorker, Teddy Roosevelt. Back home in the city, he would often dine in one of the better restaurants like Delmonico's and then spend the rest of the evening at the Lambs Club or the New York Athletic Club or one of the several German societies to which he belonged. Huggins' typical evening was spent at home with his sister Myrtle.
Okay, both Rupert and Huggins had fathers who were very strict, who tried to guide them away from baseball. Rupert said that his dad said at one time, and I quote, "This ball-playing business is all nonsense. You go to the brewery," and Rupert had to give up a possible career in baseball. Miller Huggins' sister once said that their father was a strict Methodist who abhorred frivolity and listed baseball as such, especially baseball played on Sunday. And as you can see from the quotes here, they were not real public figures, and certainly people like Babe Ruth got a lot of the attention. Both of these men were also quite colorless people. Huggins has been described by one New York reporter as like an old oak tree against a gray winter sky. And Rupert himself was mentioned in an editorial in Baseball Magazine that he didn't care much for the spotlight. Both of these men were bachelors, neither married, and they both had some interesting views on marriage. Huggins spoke more about the fact that he wishes that he would have had kids, that he could have done for a boy things that maybe his own father didn't have money for. In the case of Rupert, he often spoke about all the beautiful women in New York and was often seen in public. Lyle and I, in looking at this, we present the evidence, but we suggest that the women that Rupert was with were pretty much beards, for those of you that know what the phrase means. And when Rupert died, he left a third of his estate to a 37-year-old Broadway former actress, but really their relationship was probably like a father and a daughter. There was a short-lived magazine that targeted gay men in urban centers in the United States in 1937 and 38. Rupert was featured in one issue of the magazine, along with actor Tyrone Power, literary critic Alexander Wolcott, playwright Noel Coward and fashion photographer and designer Cecil Beaton. Both of these men were serious businessmen. The amazing thing is sometimes when they talk, either about New York and the Yankees or about business, Lyle and I almost had to make sure that we were crediting the right person, because a lot of times what Rupert said could have come out of the mouth of Huggins or vice versa. Both of these men invested in real estate quite heavily. Ironically, it appears that Huggins got out of Florida before the land crash in late 1927, where Rupert may have been more exposed and was still pretty deep into it. The Huggins picture here was taken shortly after he signed with the Yankees in 1918, and as you can see, he does project being a rather serious man. Both of these guys, Rupert and Huggins, were amazing judges of personnel. Here's a quote from John McGraw about what he thought the skills of Miller Huggins were way back when Huggins was a manager with the St. Louis Cardinals. And in the case of Huggins, it was very rare that he traded somebody away who went on to be a star somewhere else. Urban Shocker and Muddy Rule were a couple notable exceptions, and he got Shocker back in the mid-20s. In the case of Jacob Rupert, as any owner, one of the main things that a owner can do is hire the right kind of people who are his direct reports. Rupert hired 6 key baseball people in his career. 4 of them were absolutely brilliant hires. Huggins, as well as the 3 men in the slide on the right, George Weiss, Joe McCarthy, and Ed Barrow. And the only other 2 people that maybe didn't work out as well were his manager before Huggins, Wild Bill Donovan, a former star pitcher, and former Yankee pitcher Bob Shockey. And we explain in the book why really Rupert had to hire maybe not the caliber of manager that he ultimately wanted. The other thing that both of these men had is they both had to deal with the Babe, and the Babe gave them a lot of headaches. Ultimately, Huggins had more headaches, and when he died prematurely, his sister said that this guy, Babe Ruth, took 5 years off of my brother's life.
Both men understood the demands of owning a team or managing a team in New York. The New York fans and press were no different than they are today. I don't want to say obnoxious, but they were difficult. Yankee fans want a winning ball club, Rupert said. They won't support or tolerate a loser. The psychology of New York is entirely different, Huggins said. You've got to make good. New York fans are never satisfied with being second best. As I say, nothing has changed. Despite cries from around the league to break up the Yankees, and this was both when Huggins was manager and later when McCarthy was the manager, Rupert and Huggins both recognized the difficulties of staying on top. Rupert's response to the break up the Yankees was, "Don't tear down my team, build up yours." He was always looking to add good new players, a slide, a broken leg, and the finest ball player's career could be over, he said. This has happened before, and it may happen again. We have to have replacements. He compared it to keeping his brewery on top. If a part or a machine breaks down, you replace it. Huggins' response to the break up the Yankees crowd was more philosophical. Time will take care of the Yankees, as it takes care of everything else, he said. This team, powerful as it is, will crack and break, no matter what any of us does to keep it up. The history of all great teams and all great personal fortunes is the same. They dominate the scene for a while, but they don't last. Great teams fall apart and have to be put together again. To the extent possible, both men wanted to control their own destinies. Ed Barrow described Rupert and Houston as 2 self-willed personalities who, by background, manner, and outlook, were worlds apart. A New York sportscaster said Rupert ran his brewery the way he wanted it run. He was in complete charge. He was there every day in his office. He had his finger on every part of the development and sale of that beer. He was a tough guy. Huggins had actually hoped to buy the Cardinals in 1917, but when that fell through and Ricky became his boss, he knew he would no longer have any control, and he left for the Yankees. Rupert saw the potential in Sunday baseball, in the building of Yankee Stadium, and in building up his farm system. But he was by no means perfect and clairvoyant. He lagged in the areas of integration, night baseball, and radio broadcasts of games. He was slow to come to radio and to night baseball. Huggins had been a quintessential dead ball type player, but he recognized and quickly adapted to the coming of the long ball era. Of course, having Ruth and Gehrig on his side made that a pretty easy transformation. Both men also had to overcome enormous obstacles. Rupert lost his primary source of income with the coming of Prohibition, and then he had to take on and eventually take down both the president of his league and then his partner. Rupert faced repeated challenges to his authority from the start, beginning when he was a Cardinals manager. A 1922 Sporting News editorial said, "Perhaps never in the history of the game has a manager been so flouted, reviled, and ridiculed." That still may be true today.
Okay, one more thing about the challenges they faced with Babe Ruth. In 1925, Huggins finally faced down the Babe and suspended him, and Ruth thought that for sure Rupert would back him up and fire Huggins. And Rupert's reaction was, no, it's Huggins' team, and Babe Ruth can quit if he wants. Ultimately, in the 1930s, Rupert had to deal with the Babe directly when Babe wanted to manage the Yankees, and Rupert decided that he was not able to do it.
We got an excellent. Yeah. Okay, both men loved baseball. It meant the world to them and it brought meaning to their lives. After acquiring Ruth, Rupert told the press that it was his life purpose to give New York a championship team. In 1923, 8 years after buying the Yankees, he said, "Here I am, deeper than ever in baseball and more in love with the game than ever." That year, after the Yankees won their first World Series, Damon Runyon wrote of Rupert, "The possession of great wealth is an old story to him. There was no novelty for him, no thrill in the buying excesses of great wealth. It was the thing that money couldn't buy that brought him his big, bright hour." Rupert called winning the 1923 World Series the happiest day of his life. Huggins, again, had few interests outside of baseball. On off days during the season, he would often go to the Yankees' offices in downtown. "Baseball is my life. I'd be lost without it. Maybe, as you say, it will get me someday. But as long as I die in harness, I'll be happy." And, of course, it did get him. And, of course, he did die in harness.
And that's Mayor Jimmy Walker in the middle in the slide on the right. The picture here on the right has Rupert with Barney Dreyfus, the owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates before the 27 series. And in 1925, 24, and 26, 3 years in a row, the series won seven games. And there was some rumbling and talk that maybe the players were, the teams were maybe trying to make the series go longer to make money. When the Yankees swept the Pirates in four games in 1927, Ruth lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. But he said, "I am happier in what I believe is a great thing for baseball. It will cost us something like $200,000, but there can be no talk now of stringing out a series. We wanted to win in four straight, and we did, because we have a wonderful team." This slide is one of the central things in terms of the similarities between the two men. These men absolutely wanted to win. Second place was no good for them. It was almost as bad as last place. And the quotes here really convey it. Another sports writer, Sid Mercer, had said, "Winning, talking about Rupert, was a mania with him. These two men almost got physically ill when they would lose." And I think we talk in the book how Rupert's idea of a good ball game was where the Yankees scored 10 runs in the first inning, and then they pull away from there. And both of these men spoke similarly about winning. One of them said, "It is our desire to have a pennant winner each year indefinitely. New York fans want championship ball, and the Yankees can be counted on to provide it." That happened to have been Huggins. Rupert said, around the same time, after the 1927 season, "I want to win the pennant five more years in a row if we can. We're going to go ahead and get any good ball player we can. Winning pennants is the business of the New York Yankees. These men were fiercely loyal to each other. The Yankees lost the last three games of the 1921 World Series and were swept in the 22 series. There was one tie game. And after the series, Rupert's partner, Colonel Houston, probably drunk in a New York crowded bar, shouted that Miller Huggins had managed his last game for the Yankees. And when Rupert heard about it, he exploded. And this was his reaction. And he very soon set in motion to buy out his partner. And in 1923, when he finally did and the Yankees were on the road, he sent a famous telegram to the club. And he said, "I am now the sole owner of the Yankees. Miller Huggins is my manager." Really, these men had discovered the winning formula. F.C. Lane of Baseball Magazine said something that still applies today. "The combination of brains and money is a hard pair to beat. The attempt to divorce wealth and intelligence from all advantage has never succeeded anywhere." These two men knew what it meant to win and began to lay the foundation for a Yankee dynasty that continued on. Huggins was not recognized until 1964 when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, which seemed like a long time. But I guess that's quickly, considering that Rupert had to wait almost another half century. Thank you. We have time for some questions.
If you have a question, please come up to the microphone so the audience can hear your question.
Did Steinbrenner ever make any reference? Did he have any significant appreciation that he expressed for either of these two guys?
My experience is that baseball teams and baseball players, people in baseball, have no sense of their own team's history. And I think probably Steinbrenner was no different. I don't think he recognized Rupert.
Thank you.
Marty Appel wrote the forward to our book, and he talks about the fact that really Rupert was the one that created the masterpiece, the Mona Lisa, as he referred to it.
What was the nature of Huggins' health problems, and what was the reaction upon his premature death?
Well, he was never a strong guy to begin with, and I think he didn't handle stress well. He had everything from bad teeth to neuritis. Ultimately, he had an infection that in our earlier book we talked sidelined him during 1921, and what killed him at the end was an infection under his eye, a little pimple that got infected. But in the era before antibiotics, the poison, it was called erysipelas, was the medical term then, it just raced through his body. And when he finally got around to checking into a hospital, he was dead within 3 days.
Thanks for your presentation. I have a question. How much did Rupert rely upon his political connections while he was running the Yankees?
How much did he rely on his
political connections?
He, to be a big businessman in New York at that time, you had to have some connections to Tammany Hall, and he did. But he wasn't really heavily involved. Tammany Hall got him his congressional seat and certainly helped him, but he was not closely connected.
When the New York Giants owned New York, and they were basically the team in New York, the feeling was that any other team that came in that tried to build a big stadium, McGraw and the Giants would just get a road built right in the middle of it. But McGraw met more than his match in Rupert, both in terms of political connections and ultimately in terms of money and commitment to winning.
Who was responsible for the decisions on scouting and endorsing the scouts' recommendations on all the talent that they brought in?
Well, you know, there's a third key player in this, and that is Ed Barrow. And as we make very clear in our introduction, there's already been a terrific biography of Ed Barrow written by the Bob Davis Award winner, Dan Levitt. In the early years, Huggins and his scout, who he brought over from St. Louis, Bob Connery, was doing it. Ultimately, when Connery moved on and bought a minor league club, Barrow began to develop an amazing staff of scouts. And by that time, the Yankees had to draw from the minor leagues and ultimately build a a farm system because there were no players that they could get from the majors anymore. They'd taken that talent from Boston.
You mentioned that Houston wanted to dismiss Rupert after 22. Was he always, dismiss Huggins after 22. Was he always kind of, did he not like Huggins all along, or was it something that kind of developed over time? Was Rupert the one who made the decision to hire Huggins? I'm just wondering what kind of the relationship there is.
She's asking
the dynamic.
Houston, was it?
That's kind of a multi-part question.
Did he not like Huggins from the start, or did?
Yeah, he did not like Huggins from the start. His choice of manager was Wilbert Robinson, and the Dodgers manager, and they made a serious. He made a serious attempt to get Robinson. But Rupert backed Huggins almost from the beginning. I mean, he was reluctant when he first met him, but once Huggins convinced him of what he could do, he backed Huggins all the way.
And it was a little bit confusing because Ban Johnson, the president of the American League, and Colonel Houston did not get along. And Ban Johnson was instrumental in bringing Huggins over from the St. Louis Cardinals. So in many ways, we've never been able to find out why Johnson and Houston had that conflict. They both came from Cincinnati. Something must have happened. So part of the problem was that Huggins was Ban Johnson's man, and Houston hated Johnson.
And it was kind of getting back at the National League for hiring Branch Rickey away from the American League.
I have a question about, you mentioned that Babe Ruth lost several hundred thousand dollars because the 27 World Series only went four games. When did they put the rule in that said that money would not go to the teams that were playing after the fourth game? Because that's certainly what I grew up with. I just didn't know when that changed.
That rule was very early in the World Series. There was a famous story with Germany Schaefer, and when there was a tie game, I think it was in the 1907 series. And so that four-game rule well predated 27 by at least two decades.
So how would Babe Ruth have lost money?
How
would Ruth have lost money if they...
He had advanced ticket sales for Game 5 alone would have been the live gate. Obviously, it's the live gate.
I have one more question about Rupert and his father. You said they were Methodists. I grew up in a small town where... three or four places, there were WCTU water fountains, and the WCTU, of course, took a great stand against alcohol. That was a Methodist organization, and I'm just wondering if there was any conflict between Rupert and his product.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the Methodist religion, so I won't comment. But one of the things that we do comment in the book is, I think the minister at his funeral was like Episcopalian. There were like a number of religions that sort of touched Huggins when he died.
Miller Huggins was an attorney. Did he ever practice law?
I think Miller Huggins did practice law briefly. There was a Judge Orr in St. Paul that one winter he clerked for, but practically not at all. The story was that future President Taft was his professor at the University of Cincinnati, and he said, "You've got to pick one, baseball or the law, and it appears that you like baseball more." We're not sure if that story is true or one of these baseball myths.
Between Huggins and Joe McCarthy, there was at least one other manager. Was it Bob Schalke? Was he just a blip on the radar, or how did he get in and out so quickly?
Well, he was one of, as Steve said, he was one of Rupert's two poor hires, and I think Rupert felt he owed it to Schalke. He was the longest tenured Yankee, but he had his eye on McCarthy even then.
Yeah, we talk in the book that Rupert really wanted to hire a couple other people, Donnie Bush and then Eddie Collins, and for different reasons he was unable to get them. And then he went on to Schalke. When Joe McCarthy became available, and there's a whole story behind that in the book, and Schalke felt for many years he got a raw deal. He came to the office and he saw Joe McCarthy walking out of Rupert's office, and he knew right away what was up. I think he only had a one-year contract, so he may not have been fired, but he was not rehired.
Great. Stephen Lyle, thanks. We appreciate that. It was wonderful. Thank you.